Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Web at helpstophunger.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In just 3.5 weeks now, voting begins for Democrats choosing a challenger to George Bush. January 19th is the Iowa caucus. On Point has brought you conversations with Wesley Clark, Al Sharpton, Joe Lieberman, Dennis Kucinich, Dick Gebhardt, and Howard Dean. Tonight, we turn to Senator John Edwards. He was golden early in the campaign, but has flagged recently. Nationally, the Southerners' poll numbers now run in the low single digits. In must-win South Carolina, a poll out today puts the North Carolina senator running fourth, behind Dean, Clark, and Sharpton. But John Edwards, with his boyish good looks, his self-made millions, and his buoyant populism, says he'll run and win just like Bill Clinton did. Tonight on Point, presidential contender John Edwards. Earlier, I caught up with candidate Edwards on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. Senator John Edwards, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here.
John Edwards, we want to hear about your positions tonight, where you stand on the issues in this race, but give us a little race analysis just at the top. You are a smart guy, great with the crowd, Clinton-esque in your ability to connect with people, with voters, people say again and again. Yet we've got Dean and Clark pulling ahead a bit, maybe even Sharpton pulling ahead in South Carolina, I see in a poll today. How do you analyze what's going on in this Democratic primary scramble so far?
Well, if you look at Clinton, you will use Clinton as an example. Clinton was at Christmas time in 1991. Actually, I don't think as strong as I am in New Hampshire right now, and ended up doing very well in New Hampshire. I think that what we see happening is so many voters are going to be watching this race very closely after the first of the year. We've actually been moving up pretty dramatically in New Hampshire. Same thing's been happening in Iowa. If you look at the polls as a whole, it's clear that the majority of the polls have me with a significant lead in South Carolina. So I think actually things are going well. I feel very good about it, optimistic about things.
John Edwards, you're rich. You're in the U.S. Senate. There are no shortage of Democratic candidates this year. Why are you running in this race this year?
Because there people in this country are not getting the opportunities they should get. I absolutely believe that I can change the direction of America in multiple ways, both here at home and around the world. And for me, this entire race is about what the cause of my life has been, which is giving more opportunities to people like the chances I've had myself.
You say there's a fundamental problem with the direction the country's going in. What is that in your view?
That what's happening is here at home, the chance for most middle class and working families to do well is becoming smaller and smaller every day. We've had a huge sea change in this country. Over the last 20 years, we've gone from a place where most middle-class families and those trying to enter it were able to save some money. They had some financial security, and that's all changed to the place where today they're saving nothing. In fact, they're going into debt. And the result is one thing goes wrong, if there's a financial problem, a medical emergency, a layoff, they're likely to go toppling off the edge. We have to strengthen these families and give them a chance to do better. I mean, it includes creating some financial security, helping them save, helping them to invest, helping them to have some ownership, helping them to buy a home. So I think the healthcare crisis contributes to that, and being able to educate their kids. All those issues are important, but the truth is they're part of a bigger issue that's confronting America today.
And that is?
Which is, how do we strengthen the vast majority of American families, middle-class families, and those people who are poor and the working poor who are trying to enter the middle class. And then on top of that, we look at what's happened to America's image around the world and the way America should be leading around the world. We're held in enormous disrespect in big parts of the world now, and that needs to be changed. It can be changed, but it requires a different kind of leadership than we have now.
Let's look at these one by one, first with the American middle class. If it's in as bad a situation as you say, are you suggesting that all of that happened in the last 3 years under George Bush, or does this go back to the Clinton-Gore years?
I think that it's happened over the last two decades. And one brief respite from that was in the last 3 years or so of the Clinton-Gore administration. I think actually Bill Clinton understood that the engine of the economy was the middle class. And when they have health care problems, when they have problems with jobs, when they have problems with the cost of educating their kids in college, all these things, when they don't have financial security and they're not strong, that we have trouble sustaining long-term economic growth. And so because of that, he has had policies that work. It's why we got to a surplus. It's why the middle class was stronger and growing in the last 3 or 4 years of his administration. But no, I don't pin it on a particular, you know, that certainly hadn't just happened in the last 3 years. I think this president has made a bad situation worse.
How has he done that? Every president wants financial economic security. How has Bush gone wrong in your view?
He is shifting the tax burden in the country. If you listen to the Democratic candidates running for president, everyone talks about being against Bush's tax cuts for the rich. But, see, I think there's something much more dramatic and radical going on here. I think the president is actually shifting the tax burden from wealth and the wealthy to the middle class, to work. And that, what I mean by that specifically is he wants to get rid of the capital gains tax, the dividends tax, the taxation of large estates. Those are all taxes on either wealth or passive investment income from wealth. Well, see, there's nowhere for that tax burden to go except onto the backs of middle-class families. That's what's been happening for the last 2 years. And these are the very families that I described just a minute ago who are struggling, having trouble making ends meet. The last thing they need is to have this tax burden shifted to them. We ought to be helping them, not making life more difficult for them.
John Edwards, those Americans you're talking about are numerous. There are clearly many more Americans who are not rich than who are rich. You said that if you've learned anything from your courtroom years, it's that you can't fool people. But President Bush is pretty popular right now.
Yeah, but there's a reason for that. People are worried about, I'm talking about the average American, they're worried about loss of jobs, they're worried about the economy. I think they gave him a break for some of that because of September the 11th. I think that there are a lot of people in this country who wrongly or rightly respond well to him personally. But what's happening is, and this will happen, become more dramatic as we go through this election process and campaign, is we've not been able to make the case against George Bush. He's had the bully pulpit. It's very hard to be heard. Well, see, all that's about to change. That's going to change when we have a Democratic nominee, and we'll have at least close to the same playing field that he's on right now.
If you should be that nominee, and that would take a surge, but if you should be that nominee, what would you do with Iraq? You voted in favor of going in after Saddam Hussein. You voted against the $87 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan. What would be your next move in Iraq, John Edwards?
I think we have to take the American face off what's going on there. It can't continue to be an American occupation. What we ought to do is we should go to the United Nations immediately and do everything in our power to get them to take over responsibility for the civilian authority in Iraq.
And what are they going to be able to do that the United States cannot do?
Here's what they can do. They add legitimacy to what's happening. Instead of it looking like America is hand-picking its own puppet to run the country of Iraq, see if it's the United Nations or any coalition of international coalition, it changes the way the Iraqis respond to it and the way people in that part of the world respond. The same thing is true about the security force. You know, as long as it's an American occupying force, if that's what it looks like, if that's what it feels like, we're going to continue to see the problems that we see now. We have to change that. For example, right now, we could put NATO in charge of the security along the Iranian border, along the Saudi Arabian border. We could continue to have responsibility for some of the most difficult regions like the Sunni Triangle. But we have to change the dynamic that exists on the ground. And the most important thing to do is to internationalize what's happening.
And what about security at home? You know, of course, the terror alert has gone to orange level today. What's your plan for dealing with domestic American security?
Well, there are a whole group of things we need to do. One is we need to do a much more effective job of protecting our nuclear plants and our chemical plants. You know, they're very vulnerable and they're incredibly dangerous, and we're not taking the steps necessary to keep them safe. We need to do a much better job at our ports. We have huge containers, thousands of them, coming through our ports every single day, and we inspect about 3 or 4% of them. And the result of that is if some terrorist group wanted to smuggle something into the country, the odds are overwhelming that they'd be successful. Well, we need better technology and more personnel to inspect these containers that are coming in through our ports.
Are there the resources there to do that? If there were, why aren't they deployed already?
Because the president's not doing it. For whatever reason, I'll give you another example. The chemical industry, which I just mentioned a few minutes ago, chemical plants. The administration itself recognized the problem with security at chemical plants. And when the chemical industry pushed back and said, we don't want to be regulated, we don't want this security, they backed away. And this is an example of where the obvious thing that needs to be done to keep people safe in this country is not done because there are friends of the president who don't want to do it.
You've described the U.S. government as not working well for ordinary people, for the little guy. What's the structural problem? Is there a structural problem?
Oh, yeah, there's a structural problem. The structural problem is Washington is broken. I mean, we desperately need reform. And the fundamental problem is the way political campaigns are financed and the power of these lobbies and the lobbyists in Washington. I mean, if people in New Hampshire walked around in Washington and saw what was going on a day-to-day basis, you see, you can't move up there without running into lobbies for the drug companies and insurance companies. I mean, they're all very well represented. We ought to ban those people from also making political contributions. I mean, they're lobbying. The last thing we need is for them to be having fundraisers for the people they're lobbying, the night that they're lobbying them, which is what goes on every day in Washington. I think if we really wanted to get get money out of politics, we should ban lobbyist contributions, but we should go further than that. I don't take lobbyist contributions, Washington lobbyist contributions anyway, or PAC contributions. But if we really want to solve this problem, the solution is to have public financing of political campaigns and free broadcast time so that democracy works the way it's supposed to.
Senator Edwards, you made your reputation and your fortune as a trial attorney. Trial attorneys have been big contributors to the Democratic Party. They also have kind of a mixed reputation in the American mind. Does that make you vulnerable?
No, and here's why. If you look at, in fact, I've just got a new book out called Four Trials, F-O-U-R, Trials. It talks about four of the cases that I handled during the time that I was a lawyer. And every one of those cases fighting for, you know, kids and families against big insurance companies and others. And what this book tells are the compelling stories of the people that I represent. And I what I have done is I spent most of my adult life, 20 years, before I went to the Senate, fighting for kids and families against very powerful interests in courtrooms, insurance companies, et cetera. Well, the problem is President Bush has been on the side of the insurance companies and the drug companies and the HMOs. I've always, my entire life, been on the other side. I'm proud of that. I'm proud of what I did and always will be. I think it's a strength.
John Edwards, we just have a minute left. Let me ask you very quickly about a few issues. Where do you stand on abortion?
I believe in a woman's right to choose.
On gay marriage?
I'm against gay marriage, but for a whole group of benefits for a gay and lesbian couple.
On school vouchers?
Opposed to school vouchers.
On the Bush tax cuts, what exactly would you do?
Stop the tax cuts for people who make over $200,000 a year, raise the capital gains rate for people who make over $300,000 a year, and close four specific corporate loopholes.
And finally, what about the South and the Democratic Party? Zell Miller in Georgia, a Democrat who's turned away, says that the Democratic Party has to embrace the war, has to embrace the Bush tax cuts, kind of go Bush-light to win in the South. Can the Democrats win in the South anymore?
Zell Miller's dead wrong about that. I know Zell. He's a friend of mine, but he's dead wrong. What the Democrats have to do to win Southern states is we have to have a candidate and a message that connects with voters in that part of the country. They have to have a gut-level comfort with whoever our candidate is and what our message is. And I know that I can, not just in the South, but everywhere in the country, I can do that because I got elected in a very tough place. I mean, Jesse Helms was the other senator.
How do you break out of the pack right now in the next month, in the next 6 weeks, John Edwards?
I'm going to finish my 100 town hall meetings in New Hampshire. I'm going to campaign hard on the ground. I'm going to talk about my positive vision for the future of this country. And that will break through all this day-to-day sniping that's going on between these various candidates.
Senator John Edwards, very good to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's an honor to be with you. Thank you.
John Edwards spoke with me from New Hampshire. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you make of Senator John Edwards? What's the Edwards vibe? Is the pretty face label unfair, beside the point, or is it code for inexperience? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is... I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we continue our series profiling the Democratic primary candidates. We've been talking this evening with North Carolina John Edwards. You can join our conversation tonight. What's your take on John Edwards' candidacy? Why hasn't it soared higher? And does the Democratic Party need the visceral appeal, the Southern appeal of John Edwards? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Manchester, New Hampshire, is John Wagner, Washington correspondent for the Raleigh News and Observer. He's been covering the Edwards campaign. Good evening and welcome, John Wagner.
Thanks. Thanks very much for having me.
It's great to have you with us tonight, John. Thanks for being here. And also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
So, John Wagner, what have you seen in the last few days with John Edwards on the trail?
Well, actually just got into New Hampshire this morning. He'd been out in Iowa for the past few days before that, and he's had a series of events here today, really trying to drive home a message on jobs and creating jobs in the first couple of years of his would-be presidency.
And how's it going down? The polls just out in the last couple of days don't look so great. How does it feel on the ground with John Edwards now?
He does draw good crowds generally, fairly enthusiastic and fairly large crowds. So I think he gets a vibe that exceeds what you would be reading in the polls.
We're going to come back and look at where John Edwards stands on a lot of issues tonight, but help us, John, understand exactly who John Edwards is. We've got the kind of shorthand. He's handsome. He's well-spoken. He's a trial lawyer. He was the son of a mill worker and talks about that all the time. Fill us in. I mean, he made a lot of money as a personal injury lawyer. We read his net worth is between $12 and $60 million. He's supposedly the 19th richest member of Congress. He drove a red Plymouth Duster in high school. He, and a lot of people don't know this, lost a son in the mid-90s in an automobile accident when his Jeep flipped over, but never talks about that. Who's the man behind the public image?
Well, I think actually the last bit of his autobiography that you bring up is interesting. He finally did talk about that, the death of his son, at some length in a new book that he has out. All the candidates now are putting well-timed books out onto the market is a way to gain more publicity.
Right, the one he just spoke about with us, Four Trials.
Four Trials, right. And in that book, he actually does talk about kind of what his family went through. And it really does add, some sense of depth of character to a man, as you know. He, as you noted, many people see as just a pretty face.
But he's been very... he's been very careful about putting that out there. I've never heard him speak of it, though it seems like it might give him that sense of gravitas of the history of pain and maturity that people might respond to.
Well, I do think it presents a sense of maturity that some people realize perhaps isn't there, but you have to be very careful to not be politicizing the death of your son. I think they've been very sensitive about that, and I think just for personal reasons, he's not comfortable talking about it in a political context.
And what's the John Edwards reputation in his home state of North Carolina? How did he win that seat just 5 years ago now? And what's his political standing there? We see a report out today, a poll in which he's fourth.
I think you're referring to a South Carolina poll, actually.
I'm sorry, South Carolina, across the border. But
right, which is a must-win primary state for him. He's actually born in South Carolina.
Right.
And, grew up and spent most of his teenage years in North Carolina. But he's someone who really burst onto the political scene in North Carolina out of nowhere. He was not heavily involved in politics at all. He, in fact, only voted about half the time in elections prior to his running for the Senate. And he came onto the scene as a fresh face, an alternative to Senator Lott Faircloth, who was the Republican incumbent, and who Edwards is reminding people on the trail these days that Faircloth was a Jesse Helms protege.
Mm-hmm.
So Edwards is really able to appeal to kind of the new North Carolina, the soccer moms and suburbanites. There's been a tremendous influx into North Carolina in recent years, and it doesn't necessarily fit the stereotypical bill that people would would have who associate the state with Jesse Helms.
And he announced a couple of months ago that he would not seek re-election to the Senate, whatever happens with the presidential race. That makes the stakes pretty high here in political terms. He's president or he's out. This is the year he would stand for re-election, isn't it?
It is, and that it was a tough decision, I think, for him, but it was something he had to do because there was a real strong storyline about which way he was going to go, and the longer it festered and there appeared to be indecision on his part, the harder it was to make the case that he was really committed to the presidential race.
You've said that his basic strategy from the outset has been to perform respectably in Iowa and New Hampshire and then win South Carolina and find himself a contender. Does it look like there's a possibility of him pulling that off?
Well, anything's possible, and a lot can happen in the final month when most voters finally do tune in and start paying attention. At this point, I think most people would agree that it's a fairly remote possibility, but it exists. He's one of four candidates who are really contesting Iowa at this point, and the hope there is to finish better than fourth. These early contests really are all about exceeding expectations. And, the other thing is that there's just a lot of unknowns about what's going to happen to the other candidates and who's still going to be in the mix once we do get to South Carolina.
We're talking tonight with and about Senator John Edwards, famed trial lawyer, and now lagging contender for the Democratic presidential nomination. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, you've been paying some attention to John Edwards in New Hampshire and beyond. What do you see?
Well, first of all, I see an exceptionally gifted retail politician. I've watched him at several gatherings. I watched him last night in Robbins, Iowa. And he had an electric response from the crowd, cheering, stomping. People were really, and then shook hands with each person leaving and had cogent and warming and encouraging things to say. I've seen him talk for 2.5 hours at a Tom Harkin event with very well-informed voters. And I called a friend of mine who's run political campaigns, and I said, catch this guy. And I called him back after the thing was over, and he said, you can tell if a candidate is going over if the people in the back rows are shaking their heads. And he said, I don't know whether you noticed it, but every time they showed the back rows, people were shaking their heads at John Edwards.
And Jack, what was it in his message and his delivery that got those heads bobbing?
Well, I forget. I think it was more the persona that, in fact, this man knows how to talk to people. He's actually made millions on his ability to put things in a way that people find compelling. That's what a trial lawyer has to do. And most senators talk really into that Washington void. They orate. They don't really try to persuade. This man knows how to do that. And so the disconnect to me is how this extraordinarily gifted retail politician hasn't done better. And to me, I explain it by really he has a great narrative, if there had been no September 11th. I mean, his narrative about private interests over the public interest, the biggest defeat in my time in that regard was the defeat of health care legislation of the Clinton administration in 1990. Lobbyists killed that. Then Enron. Again, lobbyists made political favors, made that scandal possible. In the Bush administration, again and again, we've seen private interest over public interest in the energy bill and the Medicaid. So he has a terrific narrative for his populist message. But September 11th changed everything, really, and I think made it very difficult for a candidate first of all, for an inexperienced candidate to emerge, and then also for a candidate who wasn't hot on that issue one way or another, and he's not.
And so that may be part of an explanation. Listeners, you can join our conversation tonight. We're talking with and about Senator John Edwards. Does the Democratic Party need the visceral appeal, the Southern appeal of John Edwards? How does John Edwards stack up against Dean Clark, George Bush? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined now from Charlottesville, Virginia, by Larry Sabato. He's founder and director of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics, author of Dirty Little Secrets, The Persistence of Corruption in American Politics. Good evening and welcome, Larry Sabato.
Good evening.
It's great to have you with us, Larry Sabato. Give us your interpretation of why John Edwards plunged ahead to a run for the presidency so quickly. He's just finishing up a first term in the Senate. Did he come out of the blocks too early here?
Probably, although if there's a surprise in the election year, I think he has a reasonable chance to be that surprise. It's unlikely, but it's possible. Did he come out of the blocks too early? Probably. Why did he do it? Well, he was very nearly picked as vice president by Al Gore. I believe he was second on the list, or so at least some of the Gore staff aide said, second to Joe Lieberman. And I think he got a taste for national politics. He was bitten by the bug. And some people say because of the tragic death of his son Wade that he decided early on that nothing in life was guaranteed and that this was an opportunity for him to move forward, and he wanted to do it.
So what most distinguishes John Edwards, apart from his affability, his kind of courtroom persuasiveness, on the issues, Larry Sabato, does he stand out from the rest of the pack?
Well, in some respects, he stands out. Certainly, he doesn't have much Washington experience. He's not, quote, tainted, unquote, in some people's eyes. I don't know that I agree with that. I think experience is a good thing. But he doesn't have that Washington experience. On positions, on the issues, he's more populist in his approach to many of the issues that are appearing in this presidential campaign. And by and large, I think he has a little bit more moderate approach because, after all, he was elected in North Carolina. To be elected in any southern state today as a Democrat, you almost have to be at least a little more moderate, a little more conservative than Democrats who win in northeastern states or west coast states.
And that populism, is that working for him or not this year?
It's working for him to a certain degree. You know, we've often talked about who would be nominated if we had some kind of preferential ballot voting where people got to list their first choice and their second choice and their third choice. He's just about everybody's second or third choice. So he might well win if somehow we had preferential voting, but we don't. And therefore, the odds are pretty steep in his case.
John Wagner, inside the Edwards campaign these days, what do they say about how the poll numbers are coming out? To what do they attribute the relative low standing here, the slide?
Well, they're clearly looking for a lot to happen in the final month. And clearly they would like things to be looking a little better than they are in Iowa and New Hampshire. But they're really hanging on to South Carolina as the beachhead and feel that if he just comes out of Iowa and New Hampshire standing, particularly if Dean is the only other real candidate at that point, they like that contrast.
But it's not looking so great right now. And what do they pin that on? Do they say that he's been unfairly kind of branded as the pretty boy, the pretty face, and that undercuts him, or is that not an issue?
I think it's just more a matter of time. And it would be interesting in his case if he had a couple more months, because there is a lag between what you see on the ground and what you see in the polls. And I think a big issue for him will be, just does he have enough time to reach these voters, particularly given his strength as retail, and it takes a long time to do that.
And the time is growing short now. We've been talking tonight with and about Senator John Edwards and his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What's the Edwards vibe that you pick up? 1-800-423-TALK. Kara's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Kara. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up one contention with a point that John Edwards made earlier this evening, which is that essentially I felt like he was advocating that we turn over a lot of the things that were going on with Iraq. We had an American face on them. He advocated that we turn them over to the United Nations. And in my mind, that very much indicated he wanted us to be manipulating what was going on in Iraq while having a United Nations face on it. That, to me, right there would sort of make me want to vote for anybody but John Edwards.
So when he says we need to get the United Nations in there to have legitimacy, you see that as a kind of a dodge?
Well, it almost seemed to me as if he didn't really want the United Nations in there. He wanted us in there with the United Nations, again, like sort of as a cop-out.
Jack Beatty, you heard the same comment from John Edwards. We didn't have time to get into everything. It's a fairly simple formula. He says, "Well, yes, it's crummy. We should have the UN face in there, and we'll have credibility that way."
But I think he goes beyond face in his discussions when he of this. I mean, he's even talked about, if I'm not mistaken, that, you know, we should have, the UN should have its share of the contracts. We should even contemplate turning over, quote, political control to the UN. In other words, that it's not just a matter of the public relations of it. The idea is that let the UN, which has legitimacy in that part of the world, manage the occupation. We'll provide the muscle, but deal the rest of the world in, and we can deal ourselves out and maybe deal more of our soldiers out. So I don't think it's quite as, I don't know, as cynical as, I can see that it could be understood that way, but I think in his, when he gives a fuller explanation of it, I think our caller would say, well, that makes a certain amount of sense.
Larry Sabato, how about it? Our caller from Wisconsin, here's a kind of posturing. Is it necessary this year for a Democratic candidate to be full on against the war to win Democratic primaries?
Probably. I think certainly we're seeing a test of that with the Lieberman candidacy, and as much as John Edwards needs to move forward to have a chance to win, Joe Lieberman needs a miracle to win. He's perhaps the most pro-Iraq war of the Democratic candidates, though he has his differences with President Bush. All the Democratic candidates are trying to draw a clear distinction between the Democratic view on Iraq and President Bush's conduct of the Iraq war. It may or may not sell, depending on circumstances. It is certainly selling with Democratic voters. And, of course, the most anti-Iraq war stand, at least it appears that way, comes from former Governor Dean. And that's probably the central reason why he's in front and the original front runner, Senator John Kerry, is not.
John Wagner, does it drive the Edwards people crazy that this feisty, fists-up candidate from Vermont is so far ahead of their, you know, well-spoken, good-looking, nice guy?
I think it probably drives all the other candidates crazy, particularly John Kerry, who has probably suffered more at the hands of Dean emerging in the must-win state for Kerry than anyone else. I mean, right now, I mean, the take from the Edwards camp is that they are, still they believe they're in a position to win in South Carolina, and as long as Dean doesn't make inroads there, they feel they're fairly well situated. There was a poll out just today, though, that showed Dean is now getting a bump in South Carolina, probably from some advertising he started down there.
A significant bump. This is the poll that puts Dean in first place with 16%, Wesley Clark in second with 12%. Al Sharpton actually tied right there with 12%, and John Edwards with 11%. Of course, there's a 5% margin of error.
And they're also 29% undecided, which
is big.
Underscore. South Carolina has not kind of developed the sophistication that New Hampshire and Iowa have yet in terms of being early states.
Even so, probably not what John Edwards expected to see at this point. We're talking tonight with and about Senator John Edwards and his run for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. My guests are John Wagner, joining us tonight from Manchester, New Hampshire, Larry Sabato in Charlottesville, Virginia. Jack Beatty's along. You can join the conversation. Are you still tracking John Edwards? Is he still on your radar screen? Is he at the top of your ticket? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We've been talking tonight with and about Senator John Edwards, famed trial lawyer and shiny-faced contender for the Democratic presidential nomination. You can join our conversation this evening. What do you make of John Edwards? How does Edwards stack up against Dean, Clark, George Bush? And are you hungry for some Southern populism for the little guy when the dust settles in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina? Will John Edwards be standing? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Earlier this afternoon, I spoke with a candidate on the campaign trail in New Hampshire. Here is an Edwards ad now running in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina.
Did you know we're in an economic recovery right now? What they call a jobless economic recovery. Where I grew up, if you don't have a job, you don't have a recovery.
Working men and women have given John Edwards high marks for his record and his plan. Block unfair trade agreements, end tax breaks for companies who move jobs overseas, and give tax cuts to companies who create jobs here.
We ought to give tax breaks to American companies who will keep jobs right here in America.
I'm John Edwards, and I approve this message.
John Edwards, ad on the air in New Hampshire, Iowa, and South Carolina. Larry Sabato in Charlottesville, Virginia. What about this South Carolina primary? February 3rd, it's really being talked up as incredibly important. How is it likely to ripple through the rest of the primary season?
Well, certainly for John Edwards, if he doesn't win South Carolina, he's out. He can, as some of his people have suggested, he can claim that, you know, a close second's good enough. No, it isn't. He has to win it outright. And just a week later, he has the Virginia primary and the Tennessee primary on February 10th, two other neighboring states to North Carolina. He has to win at least one of those two, if not both of them. If you can't win your neighboring states and your senator from North Carolina, where are you going to win? So he's got he can explain away Iowa and he can explain away New Hampshire, but he can't explain away South Carolina.
And what about Howard Dean showing up today at the top of this single poll, one snapshot, admittedly, but here he is at top of the heap. What do you make of that, Larry Sabato?
I think it's mainly momentum. I saw the poll. There have actually been other polls showing Dean either tied or being very, very close to the top in South Carolina. But South Carolinians, by and large, aren't focused on presidential politics. By the way, most of the person actually leading is this fellow named Undecided in South Carolina, and most of those people won't vote, the ones who said they were undecided. I think South Carolina, no matter what the activists in that state say, is going to pretty much be a function of what happens in Iowa and New Hampshire.
And Larry, look down the road for us for just a second. If John Edwards doesn't get the Democratic nod this year and he's not running for the U.S. Senate, are we going to see more of him politically, or is he back to the courtroom, on to something else, out of politics?
He's hoping that he'll get the vice presidential nod. He almost got it 4 years ago, and the nominee may decide that he needs a Southerner on the ticket, and there aren't that many available.
But there are two. There's Clark.
There's Clark. There's former current Senator Graham, former presidential candidate Graham. There are other people. Senator Bill Nelson of Florida is a possibility. Retiring Senator Breaux from Louisiana. There are people who can be picked. So I'm not sure that John Edwards is even at the top of the list of the Southerners who might be picked for vice president. If Edwards doesn't win the presidential or vice presidential nomination, I think he's probably finished. Remember, he turned his back on North Carolina, and North Carolinians have been giving him very low ratings. They are not happy.
You mean he turned his back in not running for the U.S. Senate again?
Not running for the Senate again, and halfway through his very first elected term, turning his attention away from local issues and toward presidential issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's probably finished politically if he can't win this year.
Larry Sabato, it's been great having you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Larry Sabato is founder and director of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Jay is calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I had 2 points I wanted to make. I was excited about Edwards. I met him, and it completely dropped. He didn't.
Why, Jay?
He just had the typical politician looking around, didn't care about actually the person right there. And then the second point I want to make is he just lacks a huge amount of experience. He doesn't have. He's just done one term in Senate, and he hasn't proven himself. He hasn't. What can he say that he's done for the American people while he was in Senate? What bills did he work on?
Well, of course, he did work on bills, but does Howard Dean have so much more experience?
I think he has two. Doesn't he have two terms in Vermont? And he has made choices on things and decisions on things.
So you give him that executive experience, and you didn't feel that famous warmth. Jay, thanks for your call. Jack, here's one man in New Hampshire who didn't get the electricity from John Edwards.
Well, I'm sure that happens with meeting politicians. But as I say, just in watching him on TV, the parallel I have is with Bill Clinton, who had that kind of one-to-one connection with voters, with this difference. Bill Clinton was always sort of less fuzzy. He was always sharp and knowledgeable about every issue, whereas I think with John Edwards, there's more a kind of attitudinal assimilation to the issues. He sort of gives you a sense of what he feels. Mm-hmm. Bill Clinton told you right down to the last syllable what he thought about something.
A little softer. And John Wagner, what about the experience issue? What do the Edwards people say when that comes up? He has not been in public service for long.
He has not, and they've tried to argue that that's actually a strength, that there are other types of experience you can bring to the table that are valuable. In fact, and he's really sharpened his message on that in just the last few days, arguing that the time that he spent as a lawyer handling medical malpractice and personal injury cases, where he fought against HMOs and insurance companies, have prepared him to take on special interests, be it in the courtroom or be it in Washington.
And has he laid out a plan for health care? I know he's talking about a plan for college expenses, where a $3 billion plan, College for Everyone, where there would be a free year of college for anybody working 10 hours a week in public service, I guess, paid for by taking back the tax cuts for wealthy Americans. But what about health care and John Edwards, John Wagner?
He has. In fact, he has a fairly detailed policy agenda. It's unlike Clinton in that these are not drawn from years as serving as governor. He's crafted a lot of policy on the fly as his candidacy has been going. But it's as specific as anyone's at this point.
And what's the gist of it? How does he solve the health care knot?
Well, his plan is not a dramatic departure from any of the others. They are cobbling together various approaches to build on existing programs. Probably the most unique wrinkle of Edwards is that he would mandate that parents either get private insurance for their children or that they enroll them through a government program.
So one way or another, everybody under 21 would be covered, as I recall.
It would be the law. Parents would be held responsible to do so.
Ken's calling from Walpole, Massachusetts. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, you're talking about how whether or not the people that are the candidates are getting their message out. And it's my opinion that they really haven't, the media, like the TV media, I don't have rabbit ears, but they're a huge impediment to the candidate. They characterize the candidates in however they want to. And I find a lot of it derogatory.
Do you find you're not hearing enough of what John Edwards really has on his mind?
I'm not hearing the issues. That's right. I'm hearing that, the guys were fighting last night, and that's all here, and I don't hear much else than that.
And when you do hear him, we talked with him for 15 minutes at the top of the hour. Does he sound appealing to you, Ken?
He does. I like Edwards. I've been saying that. I like Edwards, Clark, Dean, and Gephardt. So those are my four top.
You've got a bounteous buffet waiting for you there.
Well, I'm glad that they're all in there. I'm glad Sharpton's in there, Kucinich. I'm glad they're all there.
Ken, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
John Wagner, what about the Sharpton factor in South Carolina? Here he is showing up a point ahead of John Edwards. What does that mean?
Well, there is one thing that will be taking place in South Carolina that isn't true so much in Iowa and New Hampshire is you have a large population of black voters. And by some estimates, as much as half the Democratic primary electorate will be black. So, I mean, Sharpton has an appeal in that community, and
proud, and they're standing up for him right now.
Well, I think in all honesty, a lot of this still is name recognition when you look at these polls.
Yeah.
Because as has been said a couple times now in this program, that in South Carolina they're just not quite as attuned to the race as they are in the other early states.
Jack's calling from Eagle River, Wisconsin. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
I wanted to mention the anti-war vote that will go toward the liberal side and Dean will not play out probably across the general electorate, I wouldn't think. That's what worries me because I would support the anti-war position too. But my main point is, looking back, every successful Democratic candidate that has won the presidency has been, recently anyway, has been from the South, LBJ, mm-hmm. Carter, Clinton.
No question.
So that might augur somewhat well for the North Carolina candidate.
So let's put it right to you then, Jack. From what you've heard, are you prepared to stand up for John Edwards or Wesley Clark because they're Southerners?
Well, you know, not really. It's just that every time the latest guy I hear is the guy I'm most impressed with. I heard the general this afternoon, mm-hmm. and I thought, boy, there's an intelligent candidate. And each time I hear a guy, Kerry, same thing. And, you know, maybe it's just because I'm an incurable Democrat, but it just seems as though these candidates are all worthwhile. And I just hope that whoever comes out of this, of course, will be successful.
Jack, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, it sounds like we've got great candidates falling out of the skies here.
Well, I have watched each of these candidates in forums in Iowa for, well, I guess, 2.5 hours with Tom Harkin. And I've been watching politics a long time, and I would agree with Jack. These are exceptionally well-informed, able public men and women. I've seen, they're all well-spoken. They have varying levels of experience and varying levels of political gifts, but this is by no means a light field. And to his other point about the South, yeah, 153 electoral votes. And as someone told us on our show a few weeks ago, if you lose all of them, you're going to get 80% of what's left. That's tough.
80% of what's left after the South.
Yeah.
But still, John Wagner, the ripple for a Southerner just because he is a Southerner, that is Edwards or Clark here, doesn't seem inevitable.
No, and I think it's difficult to really know, you know, what goes through voters as they make their calculation as to where they're going to go, but they don't always look forward to who can win the general election. I mean, they feel a visceral connection with a candidate who, you know, is popular in their state and don't always play that forward.
John, what about the Howard Dean comments about the stars and bars, the Confederate flag a month and a half ago now? Has that passed on through the southern skies and disappeared, or is it still an issue? Does it still rankle?
Oh, I think we'll continue to hear about it and at least hear references to it. It was one of Edwards' moments in the spotlight at that debate in Boston where he got up in Dean's face essentially and accused Dean of being condescending toward Southerners, particularly white males who Dean seemed to be stereotyping as driving pickup trucks mm-hmm. with Confederate flags.
And what about that kind of feisty, two-fisted approach? It seems to have served Howard Dean very well. Does John Edwards have that in him?
Well, he's been trying to channel his anger, if you will. He's presenting himself as the candidate of optimism, and the line he's been using on the trail quite a bit lately is that Democrats have to present more than anger. And so he's trying in some ways to have it both ways, to direct his anger toward George Bush, but to say we really need to do more than that and offer a detailed policy prescription.
John Wagner, it's been great having you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
John Wagner joined us from Manchester, New Hampshire. He is Washington correspondent for the Raleigh News and Observer. He's on the road with candidate John Edwards. So here we are, Jack. A trial lawyer, a relative novice, comes in, gets great early reviews, and goes straight into a race for the presidency. It doesn't look like it's working out quite yet, but he's been out there shoulder to shoulder, and you say he works up the crowd.
In, from what I've seen, he does. The trouble is, of course, without television, you don't reach many of them. And this crowded menu of candidates means that in the debates, nobody really has a chance to shine through except really the hottest candidate, which has been Howard Dean.
So are you going to look for John Edwards on down the road if he doesn't make it this time, Jack, or bye-bye?
Gee, I think he's got a lot of talent, but you can't run in politics unless you've got a base, and it's hard to see if he bails out of this what his base would be.
Yep. Jack, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Okay, thank you.
Listeners, you can listen to our interviews with John Edwards, Howard Dean, Wesley Clark, Al Sharpton, Dennis Kucinich, Joe Lieberman, and Dick Gephardt on our website. The address is onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook.